How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. With rising gas prices hitting American wallets, the Obama administration is pushing its vision of having 1 million electric cars on American roads by 2015. With electric-driven autos just starting to show up in dealer showrooms in a handful of American cities, how realistic is that goal? Automakers say they're looking for signs of how much consumer demand materializes for vehicles that are totally or partially gasoline-free. Customers will have more choices this year than ever, but it's anyone's guess how fast EVs will move from a niche to the mainstream. Today we welcome our live audience in San Francisco and auto experts from five companies who will discuss the shape of things to come. Forrest Beenham is Vice President of Government Relations with Coda Automotive. Oliver Kuttner is CEO of Edison 2. Bill Reiner is National Manager with Toyota. Mike Robinson is VP for Environment, Energy, and Safety Policy at General Motors, and Dan Sperling is a member of the California Air Resources Board and a professor at UC Davis. Please welcome them to Climate One. Gentlemen, thanks for coming. Good to have you here. Bill Reiner, let's start with you.
Let's start with Dan.
Okay. We'll get to him, believe me. Toyota is in some ways synonymous with hybrids. People, hybrid hegemony is a term that's used out there. And so Toyota has a pretty strong position with hybrids right now. Mm-hmm. And some people would say that you want to kind of maintain that position with hybrids and hold on to it as long as you can and not go as quickly as some others might to electrics where you don't have the first mover advantage. Is that fair? Are you trying to hold on to your hybrid hegemony?
Well, yeah, we've got a lot of money tied up into hybrids and a lot of intellectual property, but that's because it's a very good way to maximize the efficiency of the powertrain. I mean, you're going to get 38% to 40% efficiency, and it's a very difficult platform to compete against. And so we still see a lot of the market moving toward us, not ahead of us. And in electric cars, pure electric cars specifically, there's very little first mover advantage, and you're out there trying to figure out where the infrastructure is going to go and how the tow service works and what happens when your charger doesn't charge your car and all the stuff that some of the competitors are going to go through. So there's very little first mover advantage. And I do want to correct something, is that one of the programs that I actually managed was a retail program. I think we're the only company to ever have sold retail electric cars, and we did that in 1998 or 99, sometime around there.
So Toyota sold them rather than lease them, as some other companies mm-hmm. did.
Could I disagree with one point that...
Sure.
Bill said there's no first mover advantage. And I think that's true to the extent of the technology and maybe getting mass market. But it does create a halo for the entire company, which Toyota understands better than anyone, what the Prius did. Yeah. And I think what Nissan is benefiting from, and GM to some extent, is this halo, which may not translate into direct sales of the vehicles, but creates a halo for the company that raises the profile, makes them look environmental, high-tech, and is great for the entire suite of vehicles that are sold by the company.
I'm a little cynical about that, because that opens the door wide for greenwashing, and I think the companies here are pretty opposed to doing that. And so when we talk about the halo effect and whether a company is a true environmental company, it has very little to do about the actual products you offer and a lot to do with how you offer the product. So how you address the landfill, how you address the carbon from the factories, how you address the end of life. I mean, that's the really true environmental stuff and the stuff that never gets talked about. Everybody says, well, a bigger battery is a greener car, and it's not necessarily all.
But you acknowledge that the Prius gave Toyota a tremendous halo that other companies want.
Sure.
I'm a non-car guy, but didn't the brand value?
Oh, yeah, no, I won't disagree with that at all.
Mike Robinson?
To Dan's point, with General Motors and the Volt, I would tell you that vehicle has given us permission to have an entirely different dialogue with our customers than maybe we could have had prior to this. It has opened some people's eyes to other offerings that are good choices, whether they're electric or not. In the context of your opening statement, Greg, about the volumes that we're going to be looking at. You're probably going to ask us about that. The president didn't get those volume predictions from us, but we're certainly very excited about our product, and we think the Volt does some things that no other product will do. And we learned a lot during the same period that Bill was referencing in the late 90s, early 2000s. We were one of those companies that leased the vehicles and learned a heck of a lot about nickel hydride. A lot of those same learnings have been applied to what we're doing now with Volt. And balancing act that we've come up with for that product program is to provide enough range on the battery that people get the benefit of that. For the most part, that covers 75% of the population to and from work. The extended range capability on the vehicle deals with the range anxiety issue that we all talk about and worry about. So for us, at this point in time, we think it's a good balancing act. Customers are responding pretty well to it, and the feedback we're getting from the customers is very positive. But that doesn't mean we're going to sell a million by 2015 in the industry. None of us are smart enough to know exactly what that volume is going to be, right? But we're optimistic that if we can get the costs down enough, it's ultimately a value proposition for the customer. It's got to make sense from a financial standpoint.
Mike Robinson is Vice President of General Motors. And I want to pause for a second here. Can you hear all of us out there?
No,
okay.
Well.
All right. So we need to get the sound levels up. I can hear some people better than others. Yeah. How's that better?
Is this better?
Yeah, his is on.
Really, really.
Turning it on helps. That's there we go. All right. Okay. Mike Robinson is Vice President at General Motors. We're discussing electric vehicles at Climate One. Okay, so we're talking about unit volumes, a million units. That's the goal for 2015. And what I'm hearing is that you're not sure, no one's sure we're going to get to that level. I mean, the Department of Energy numbers have 125,000 volts starting next year. Are you going to make that money? Are you going to make that much?
I'd like to know who they talk to about those volumes. this is an interesting time. People are looking for optimistic projections, I think, about what the numbers are actually going to be. Our volume that we've talked about for next year is about 45,000. Now, we want to be prepared to ramp up if the market demands more than that. But the one thing we want to do with this technology is make sure we don't overproduce, before it's time. I think Toyota would probably agree with this. You want the demand to exceed by some number the supply that you have available, and you want to make sure the quality is right for sure. And that's our plan right now.
Well, we're talking about scale. Let's get Forrest Beenham from Coda Automotive in here. You're a startup company. History's littered with lots of companies trying to get into the auto business. You have some very savvy and prominent members on your board, former Secretary of Treasury. You hired a lot of people from General Motors. Do you think that a startup can really get in this business and build purely electric cars in a volume that's really going to be meaningful?
Well, I don't think we would be in this business if we thought it would fail. As a startup, Coda is a musical term, which means the end of one movement and the beginning of the next. And for us, that means moving away from our dependence on fossil fuels and adopting an electrification model of transportation. When there's a discussion about the halo effect, we're kind of sitting on the back line because that's an expensive halo in terms of marketing dollars to get that type of first entry brand recognition. The title of this panel implies pole position. For someone of my generation, there was a video game I spent far too many hours playing, which implied there's a race to finish. And as we talked about before this panel, it's really about just kind of all being together to move toward the acceleration of the electric vehicle, whether it be a hybrid or an all-electric vehicle. But to your question, we absolutely believe that there's a place in the market for an electric vehicle in the future.
Yeah, it's probably going to be counterintuitive to your audience, but we're actually pulling for one another to be successful in the sense that we want the technology to be successful. We all have different approaches to solving this issue, but the worst thing that can happen for any of us is to have the technology fail because it's not right, the customer doesn't know how to use it, There's an education component to all of this to sell mass markets, and we really want the technology to succeed.
And so if one of you fails, it kind of the mud or blood splatters on
we're
the others, effective. Right?
Yeah, yeah, we're all effective.
And it doesn't necessarily...
Bill Reiner.
I'm sorry. It doesn't necessarily mean we've got a product failure. I mean, as we were talking, I think that the OEMs have outrun society's ability to understand how we integrate these cars into society, from the Public Utilities Commission, how we price the cars. We have a tiered pricing here in California that penalizes the EV driver right now because you're charging on tier 3 or tier 4 rates, so you might be charging it 24 cents a kilowatt hour. We've got to address that, but we have to address it in a manner that recognizes environmental justice. How does the model for public charging take place? Is it privately owned? Is it for profit? What happens to utilities if it's for profit? And then how does that change when you go to another state where that's recognized here in California and Colorado, where we're also working? It's strictly going to be public charging by the utilities and maintained by the state. So.
And I can speak, you know, from a regulatory perspective, there's huge questions on how do you handle this? Because, you know, as Bill was just suggesting, the carbon footprint of the electricity varies dramatically over time and space. And then, so how do you create incentives and regulatory structures to handle that? And that plays a big role in supporting and incentivizing what the automakers do and how they bring it out and what product, you know, because there's all this question. There's everything from a plug-in hybrid with a very small battery all the way to a pure battery EV, and it can be a big battery EV or a smaller car. So, I mean, we are, I guess, as we've been, the theme here is we're way ahead of the regulatory process, we're way ahead of the market process, the standardization issues are a challenge. So this is a big adventure, and in a, you know, a hugely important one. We've got to make this successful.
Dan Sperling is a member of the California Air Resources Board and a professor at UC Davis. Well, let's summarize then for listeners what those policy incentives are now. Someone's saying, hey, I'm interested in an electric car. They're kind of new. They're expensive. They're more expensive than traditional internal combustion engines cars. What are the incentives right now, federal and state, that will help consumers get into electric cars? Dan?
Okay, I'll list them just quickly. Is that at the federal level, there's a subsidy of $7,500 for a pure battery EV per car, and that covers quite a few cars. I believe it's $200,000 per automaker. Mm-hmm. At the state level, in California, we have a subsidy right now. It's $5,000 per car, smaller for a plug-in hybrid, and that might change. And there's $5 million per year available. That's going up to $15 million. Next year, probably, it's proposed. There's the zero-emission vehicle mandate for the car companies in California. There are subsidies from the federal as well as the state for public charging. And there's a the vehicle standards for fuel economy and greenhouse gases per vehicle in place that are structured in a way that give an incentive to the car makers to produce more electric cars.
But and to your question,
Mike Robinson,
to your question about the million volume by 2015,
right.
To Dan's point about caps, unless those caps get lifted, I don't see the math working out real well, Dan, to get to a million.
Hey, so I wasn't the author of that.
So Mike Robinson, what I hear you saying is that these incentives are good, but they don't go to enough. They won't apply to enough cars to get to a million.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Greg, is that this is going to be not just a matter of can the manufacturers build these early generation technologies, but is there a true partnership with government all the way around that gets this into the marketplace in an affordable way? Because the first generation of these technologies is vastly expensive. It's hugely expensive.
Oliver Kuttner, you're CEO of Edison, too, a car technology company. You want to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, the recurring theme is cost. I think the million cars can happen, but not by 2015. I think we've missed the first few years, and what it really takes is a structural new look at the car. In the early 70s, you had people promoting heat pumps, and people were wondering what those things were going to do. And now most people have heat pumps. That's really the same story. It's getting off of oil and gas and coal into electricity for heating your home. This is what's happening with cars today. But heat pumps became successful when you combine them with insulated homes. People weren't insulating homes in the 60s because energy was really, really cheap. It wasn't the priority. When you start to insulate the home, the heat pump can actually succeed. The heat pump can actually heat it in a reasonable time frame. The same thing is going to happen with electric cars. If we build cars the way cars are built today, you have to have 16, 24, 30 kilowatt hours of battery in the car. Right there, you're looking at a $10,000, $15,000 part today, and it's a lot of energy, there's danger with it, etc. If we were to, so to speak, insulate the cars, i.e. rethink the way a car is built, or built the car in a more efficient way, like an airplane, for example, because the payload ratio versus the equipment ratio on an airplane is favorable to a car, and the thing flies and goes fast. It just doesn't make sense that 200-pound payloads are moved by 4,000-pound boxes. However, it's very difficult to change because we have all this legacy and industry and risk and aversion. So it's, in the end, it's all about money. But if we can rescale the car to a better insulation model, then the million cars are going to happen because the cars are cheaper.
So you're talking about making
lighter. All I was arguing for now is you're arguing for tort reform, so I don't have to listen to the lawyers.
That's exactly right.
I'm all for that.
That's part of it. That is part of it.
Now, we've got the rollover standards and cray standards, and we designed to that.
Bill Reinert with Toyota,
And that really messes the car up. And, okay, we can do that later. We can put in some other XYZ materials. But there's got to be a litigating trail that shows that in somebody's involved in an accident that that is the best practice that we can put in there. It's not just magic, we can make it up and do
it. I joke about the lawyer thing because I'm a reformed lawyer, but I deal with the safety agency a lot in Washington. I understand a lot about the structure that we build into vehicles for safety compliance reasons and for litigation reasons. Oliver's right. If we could take, if we were relieved of some of those pressures and could take structure out of vehicles, it would reduce weight dramatically. The other thing we've talked about as a small group is the fact that the future, I think, will allow, it's going to be in the distant future, but we'll be able to have the ability to communicate between vehicles. Vehicles will be able to know where they are relative to one another. Systems will be in place that you can literally take your hands off the wheel and the driving won't get in the way of communicating on your computer or other things. That's the future state. That's the future state. But it's going to take time to get there because you've got all the geometry that's out there now and all the vehicles that are out there now that you have to deal with. But those kinds of things to take structure and weight out of the vehicle are technically possible. But
Oliver Kuttner?
Part of it is an architectural revisit. I mean, we are a bunch of engineers that don't know how to do cars because we're not a car company. We build race cars to tremendous effect.
Yeah.
And, racing cars survive tremendous high-energy crashes, and they do it in a different philosophy. Essentially, in a racing car, you glance off your fending object, and you shed parts, thereby dissipating energy. This may sound strange to you, but we're going to crash test a 40% offset crash car and a side impact car before this year is over, and we're going to go through it with a car that weighs 1,200 pounds and gets hit by a 4,000-pound sled. It's just physics. You can substitute mass for absorption distance.
Yeah.
When you start to have cars that require less energy to move, your power plant, your battery, everything becomes smaller, which means you have more space for absorption distance, which means you can have structures that are really good. An engine or a transmission is not a great impact-absorbing structure. It's essentially a big rock that just transfers the force. What I'm saying is a very revolutionary thought. It costs billions of dollars, but the companies that embrace it are going to own the industry.
Well, let me make that even more revolutionary.
Dan Sperling.
What we really need to do is transform the whole transportation system and the road system and how we get about in a way that, right now all vehicles serve all purposes. They're all basically, four wheels, full size, they have to perform safely on freeways. What we need is a transportation system where we can have small vehicles that can operate safely in local areas. That's where the electric vehicle, by the way, will be especially attractive. Right now, because of regulatory reasons, we have a whole gap in vehicle types. We have a low-speed vehicle that's allowed that, 25 miles per hour, up to 35 miles per hour, and nothing up to, a conventional. So our whole transportation system, needs to be revolutionary. I think in the United States that'll be slow not very complete, but the opportunity exists certainly in places like China and even Europe, where they're starting to shut down the center cities to, you know, to regular combustion vehicles. So there's a lot of opportunity bringing more information technology to it, the automation to it. You know, exactly. Our system is the most resource-intensive, expensive system you can imagine.
We're having
Bill Reiner, and then I also want to let Forrest Beenham jump in here.
We're having these discussions internal to Toyota right now about rethinking the business proposition for urban mobility. And it might not be a, I'm going to sell you a car, or I might sell you mobility services, because it does open up, and it's probably the only way you're going to see pervasive electric cars in San Francisco. There's just not the property to put charging for everybody. So you're going to do clustered charging. You might have San Francisco City Car Share, still in business, I think, or
sure.
Zipcar or someplace like that. And you might see, and in fact, you are seeing OEM start to partner up with the Hertz and the car sharing folks. And then that opens the door to Google and some other applications and Apple to add telematics to that. And so then you have a single portal from the airport to here.
So transportation could change from a product that's sold to a service model. That's a big challenge to some of these automakers here. Forrest Beenham, you're a new car company. Could you see selling a service rather than selling metal and rubber?
Absolutely. I think non-traditional partnerships are critical. And we're talking to the Zipcars and the City Ridge. I mean, it's the wave of the future. It's an absolute must. We've kind of moved past what I wanted to comment on, which was conversions versus new technology and where we focus energy. For COTA, we're focused on the battery. Literally, it's the foundation of our car. As we all know here as a panel, there's a thing called range anxiety, and for consumers, they need to feel like they can get to where they're going and get home without breaking down, or I guess it wouldn't be breaking down, but without dying, without their battery dying on the side of the road. And so what we focused on is the battery. We're not using a computer battery, for example, to power our car, or 7,000 of them strung together. We've focused on a prismatic purpose-built transportation-grade battery, which would get you that dependable range. Also, another kind of inside baseball thing we're talking about here on the stage, we've made several references to 1 million vehicles on the road in the near future, and I think many of us in the room and your listeners know this, but that is a quote that comes from the president in his recent State of the Union. So the question becomes, what is the role of government in helping us to accelerate the adoption of the electric vehicle? And I think something that would be beneficial to talk about is the role of fleets and the government purchasing electric vehicles, because we're the largest buyer and consumer of oil.
And the government is doing that. There are different government agencies that are buying, but that's still tens of thousands. That's not millions of units. But Dan Sperling put out a point about transforming the U.S. transportation system. And Oliver Kuttner, you think that the incumbent companies in Detroit and Tokyo are too conservative and risk-averse. They have too much invested in the status quo to really upend it, right? So it's going to require startups and disruptors to really bring bold change.
Well, I think part of it is that everybody thinks they know the solution. And with all due respect, we're proposing a large car that is light. It's the first light large car. We're also proposing a car that does not depend on exotic materials, because we're all about cost. So it's structural architecture that makes the car light. It's a steel car.
But do you think large companies that already have billions invested in certain paradigms can really then change that paradigm, or it has to come from the outside, startups in California?
In the end, they do it. I mean, Toyota has been working on the Prius for a long time, and when the thing started to sell a million copies, they were surprised themselves. I mean, you look at Volkswagen. Volkswagen has a now 9-year-old program trying to break the mold on how to build an efficient car called the 1-liter car. They have a wonderful car called the 1X, perhaps the nicest eco car, but it's still too small and it's still based on carbon fiber. You break those two things, you start to have the answer. When we have a car that's an EPA highway cycle, 129 miles per gallon, gasoline burning car, that when you get to those numbers, you're out of trouble. You know, when we can do with a 10 kilowatt hour battery pack what others can't do with a 18-20 kilowatt hour battery pack, your cost problem goes away, your warranty problem shrinks, a lot of these other issues start to go away. If you have a good car battery that's combined with that, yeah, but could you imagine having one of those batteries go into three cars? Suddenly your cost numbers become a lot more favorable. Suddenly your warranty liability becomes less. That's where we have to go. And in the end, the United States needs to do this with elegant engineering. We don't need to keep value engineering what we already know. We need to do better.
So you
we
think
can.
This is just an engineering question?
This is the beginning of it. Yes, it's an engineering question.
Bill Reiner?
I don't know that it's not an incremental game. I watch what happened with Ford once they've got Mihaly in place and the lightweighting going on there, and I watch our competitors. I mean, we keenly watch the lightweighting and how we're doing structured hydroforming of steels and laser welding and all that stuff. And you start to get, you know, you start to really shave serious pounds out of just the frame for the door. You can save 50 pounds just out of doing hydroforming and laser welding. So it's not that we necessarily have to reinvent ourselves. I think over time we will do that. We just as a matter of being competitive.
Well, and with due respect to all
Robinson.
With due respect to Oliver's observations, I think what's technically true in a lab test or for one purpose vehicle that's intending to achieve, let's say, a mile per gallon objective, we're providing vehicles that customers do use for multiple purposes and expect to last over 100,000 miles. And so the duty cycles of the vehicles come into play, the specific applications that the vehicles are being used for come into play, the expectations the customer has. Don't forget, the customer is going to decide what works here. The customer is going to ultimately decide, you know, who the winners are. And that's why I worry sometimes when people look at a particular electric vehicle solution as the silver bullet. I don't think we know that yet, and I think that's why the experimentation among the companies is a good thing. Customers will tell us who wins.
And let's get a baseline here. How many electric cars are actually on the road today?
Yeah.
Well, GM is one of the ones, few
yeah,
that
I mean,
has...
We've sold, at this point, and we're going to sell about 10,000 this year.
Volts.
We've sold 2,000 plus at this point.
And I understand most of those are Prius buyers coming over?
90%.
Okay.
Sorry, Bill.
When it breaks down, we'll get them back.
Don't play like that.
I know.
Actually, it's interesting because they are mostly Prius buyers.
Yeah.
So is that going to road back to my earlier question? Is that going to kind of is Toyota going to try to keep all its chips on the hybrid, or going to move more aggressively toward electric?
Well, we're doing a
watch those Volt sales closely.
Mm-hmm. We're doing a plug-in Prius. We've taken a little different job. We're putting 150 of them out in the community. We want to understand how the charging behavior and the customer merge together and what this is like. So we've got them instrumented, and I think we collect 300 channels of data every second, and that's going to be available for all the national labs and their resources board. I think we're working with you to get that done. So we want to understand how this works. So we've got the plug-in Prius coming out in 2012. My project is the IQ EV, which is the non-owned ownership model that we're going to bring here to California, working with some other people.
And you're going to lease the car to lease?
I can't get in. There will not be a financial transaction that's like a lease or a sell. It won't be that way.
They're going to be free.
They're going.
That's great.
You're going to
I'll take one.
You're going to pay a provider for service. All in service, everything.
Okay, again, so moving toward a service model.
Yeah, so you might
selling miles rather than
you might drive my IQ one day, and you might say, I need an SUV to go up to Sacramento, and you can go to the dealer and do something like that. So we're looking at that.
This is important.
Yes, Merling?
This is important what Bill's saying, and it's kind of what I was referring to earlier about the market evolving. You know, at UC Davis, we've done a lot of this market research, including with the plug-in Priuses, and, you know, it's clear that the market's going to be evolving. But we don't really, we think, you know, actually some of our research suggests that, you know, the strategy that Toyota is using is probably a very promising one, where you have a plug-in Prius with a relatively small battery, because you get a lot of the benefit with a small battery and less cost. But there's questions, you know, there's probably a big market for those that want the 40-mile range also. But we don't really know, and so we're doing lots of market research. There's the model that Bill's also talking about, you know, the shared use of vehicles. The world is going to change. The world is going to change because, you know, both from the market and the policy perspective. We're going to be tightening up very aggressively the greenhouse gas standards and the energy use in the vehicles. And that's going to cause, that by itself will cause a major, you know, that might be Oliver, you know, the solution to,
for
Oliver.
In an entirely rational universe.
Mike Robinson.
In an entirely rational universe, what Bill and Dan are talking about makes perfect sense, because when you think about how little time you spend in a vehicle and how much of an investment it represents, there's probably a more efficient way to get around.
There's actually a very interesting startup based here in San Francisco. It's called Sprite or something like that. Sunil Paul actually is trying to, it's developing a way to take the city car share model so that those of us who own cars and it sits in the garage 80 or 90% of the time, we can then lease that out to our neighbors if we dare and think they're not going to spill coffee on our chairs.
And
make money off of that, right?
The but in what I just said is the people, not everybody, but a lot of what we know is that people have, it's not necessarily rational, but they have an emotional connection to wanting to own their vehicle and take personal responsibility and pride in that vehicle. One of the things we're learning from the Volt, by the way, and we get the constant feedback. We've got the OnStar system connected. We know where the vehicles are. We know how long they've driven per day, how many miles have been put on them. We also know from the verbatims we get from the customers that the fun-to-drive aspects of this thing and the personal pride of ownership is a big deal. And so don't lose sight of that.
Well, and I'm sure that the marketing from Toyota Detroit and Tokyo won't lose sight of that. We're talking about electric cars at the Commonwealth Club. We have Bill Reinert, National Manager from Toyota, Mike Robinson, who just speaking, Vice President at General Motors, Dan Sperling from UC Davis, Oliver Kuttner, CEO of Edison 2, a startup car company, technology company, and Forrest Beenham from Coda Automotive. I'm Greg Dalton. Mike Robinson, GM's gone through a transition recently and bankruptcy, et cetera, and talks about the new GM. The old GM was a leader in the auto alliance that spent a lot of time challenging and litigating against California's clean air standards and efficiency standards. Is that still going to be the case, or do you think there's more collaborative approach with regulators such as at the Air Resources Board and other places now?
Yeah, the et cetera was a big thing. I mean, the bankruptcy and et cetera, that was a big thing.
We don't want to get down into that.
I didn't sleep much that year. But I guess I'd like to hear from Dan on how he feels about it. I think the last several years in particular have been invested in collaborative relationships with regulatory agencies across the board. I personally have directed the team at GM that's responsible for that. CARB is among our highest priorities in terms of the relationship and the reviews that we have with technical staff. I think it's a very constructive relationship. We have the same kind of dialogue on an ongoing basis with EPA and NHTSA. So my view of the world is we haven't got the luxury of resources to swing and miss or fight with one another. We've got to find common ground and solve these problems together.
So does GM support, there's a quantitative minimum called the zero emissions vehicle mandate, which stipulates a minimum production. Does GM support that for in California, whatever is 25,000 zero emission?
Did Dan put you up to this?
I'm glad you asked him.
I'm curious.
Oh, Toyota's next. Don't worry.
I'll tell you what I told Tom Paquette last week from CARB. Tom is a senior person at the CARB staff, and we have a direct dialogue with him on a regular basis. I told Tom, from my perspective, a lot has changed since the days that you described where there was a lot of fighting between the industry and CARB. And one of the things I think has changed is that we've got a single national program for the first time. I say program, not standard, because EPA's got its own standard, CARB's got its own standard, NHTSA's got its own standard, and we're working like dogs to try to, you know, reconcile these three different legislative approaches into one understandable, achievable standard or program. The next generation of 2017 to 25 fuel economy and CO2 reduction rules is going to be very important for all of us to try to keep on that path to have a single national program. I think ZEV needs to be reconciled with that program. I didn't say eliminated. I said reconciled, Dan. Because if we have a separate standalone ZEV standard that hasn't been somehow
ZEV
reconciled,
being the zero emission
vehicle standard,
right.
it creates difficulties for all of us as OEMs, as original equipment manufacturers. We want to work with the CARB staff to figure out how to do that. I don't have an answer for you that I can provide today, but we have challenges under ZEV, and I'll be, you know, Bill and I were talking earlier about fuel cells. We're both invested heavily in fuel cells and really want to see that technology come to fruition. I'd like to be able to announce a production-ready vehicle soon, but we can't do that because we don't have infrastructure that we can believe in yet to provide refueling opportunities for our customers. We need to solve those kinds of problems, and it's going to take a team effort to do it.
That's a big chicken and egg question, but Dan Sperling, let's let you jump in here on whether the car companies have changed their stripes. It's a different day than the litigation and antagonism that happened years ago.
Yeah, I'd say there has been a great change, a transformation even in terms of the relationship. If you go back to the 90s and even in the early years of the past decade, there was a lot of conflict. It was adversarial. In fact, you know, when I did this book, 2 Billion Cars, and really the motivation for it for me was the frustration over the lack of a relationship, a lack of progress in moving ahead with fuel economy standards and greenhouse gas standards. And there has been a lot of progress for a variety of reasons. But you know, there's an inherent conflict here, you know, between the regulators and the auto industry. And there is, you know, as Mike says, there is a much better working relationship. Everyone is talking to each other, exchanging information much better. But it still comes down to, you know, the question that any company, I don't even say a car company, any company inherently doesn't want to be told what to do and is protecting its business. And so, you know, and then you have the regulators operating with incomplete information because, you know, they don't tell us everything. They don't tell us what they really think and everything. It's much better than it was before. And so there is this tension about how to move forward and how aggressive to be. And that's going to, you know, that's inherent to it. And the zero emission vehicle, so the last point I would make, the zero emission vehicle program, I think, to defend that, I think that's a critical part of all of this. Now, we can put in place these aggressive CAFE and greenhouse gas standards, and we are, and we will be. But there's still a problem in getting the advanced technology into the marketplace. It's partly, you know, getting the fuel stations for the hydrogen out there. It's partly the charging station. But it's more that there's a resistance to new change. You know, consumers aren't quite ready. The car companies are looking at the risk. And so what a zero-emission vehicle program does is it, in a sense, jumpstarts, kickstarts the technology and gets it into the market. It shouldn't be a permanent program. It should be a temporary program just to get things started because, as we've said, you know, we can talk a million cars, but the reality is we're talking really tens of thousands of cars that
Bill
are
Reiner
out
there. From Toyota,
let me pick at the ARB just a little bit. And I don't disagree that there's some floor, ZEV floor, to keep us all interested. Okay. But it's my experience that over the years, and we've been, I don't know, 15 years, a long time, back when we both had hair. The failure I see at the Air Resources Board is a regulatory inability to look at vehicles as systems. The fuel and the infrastructure and the car and take a systems approach. For instance, we'd like to you have a low carbon city standard that we're going to address now, and that shapes how communities work and then how you move about in communities. We're very interested in serving that with fuel cell buses. There's a big and that could actually jumpstart the hydrogen infrastructure and cause a lot of good things to happen, but that doesn't satisfy any ZEV regulations, and we'd like to have this dialogue. We're actually probably going to try to have this dialogue, and about mobility systems to say, hey, why don't we pull back a little bit, and if we're really quit taking a look at an electric car replacing a gasoline car, and look at how we transform, as you said earlier, transportation systems, and take a real transformative effect.
We don't. Let me just defend ARB for a moment here, because I think that California has done by far the best job of coming up with a coherent approach to dealing with vehicles and fuels, you know, far more than any other entity in the world. Yeah. And we do have, you know, I mean, ideally it would be completely integrated, but there's a lot of really good people at ARB that are really engaging, not just with the auto companies, but others. And there is a program that deals with the fuels, low-carbon fuel standards, with the vehicles. We're looking at a clean fuels outlet program that will somehow figure out how to get the hydrogen out there. We're looking on the vehicle use side. We have rules and, you know, incentives for reducing vehicle use. And we're doing it in a way, you know, we with my regulator hat on, not my academic hat on, we are working at figuring out how to do that. And it's a much more coherent approach than anywhere else. Can it be done better? Absolutely. Can we, you know, refine parts of it? Absolutely, we should. And that's part of this discussion here, you know, and that, you know, Bill and I and Michael continue this.
Yeah, we're good. Timing is critical to us because Dan knows this more than the average person, but, you know, we're having this discussion about what do we do in 2015. Bill and I are working with the engineering folks. They have to make decisions today about what's going to happen in 2015. So if we were to announce, for instance, a fuel cell product, for 2015 or 16, we'd have to have in place today the pieces to make that happen.
We'd be picking out the wood grain.
Which is one reason why some people are quite skeptical about hydrogen because of that infrastructure need to be in place first. Oliver Kuttner from Edison, you want to jump in here? Then we're going to go to audience questions. We'll get the mic out here, and we can start to form a line. But Oliver Kuttner?
As a non-OEM and somebody who's going to spend the rest of his life working on this, I want to make meaning with it, and I'm very glad that things like zero emission standards exist because they become the niche opportunity for the small car company. And it's really ironic that the gentleman from Toyota was actually complaining that the zero emissions guys will not allow their buses to be counted in there. I'm very glad that these laws exist. They push, and they create the opportunity for little companies like us. The real reason we exist is because we believe that the new CAFE standard is going to get the big guys to start to scramble in about 2 or 3 years. And we actually think that there's a business model whereby if we can get our act together and be able to produce 20, 30, 40,000 units that meet these laws, and I believe we can actually meet them with an ICE and an electric car, that some of the large companies may just come along and say, you know what, we're going to buy 10,000 units from these guys. Because engineering a car that is different from anything else is a huge task. Producing it is another task. Distributing it is another task. Legislation is another task. As an upstart company, I don't want to take on all these tasks. History is littered with new upstart car companies that fail. I don't want to become a car company. But thanks to these niche rules you have, I can see myself selling my services to these two gentlemen one of these days. So I'm glad you exist.
You're welcome.
So we're discussing electric cars at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. We just heard from Oliver Kuttner, CEO of Edison 2. We also have Bill Reinert, National Manager at Toyota, Mike Robinson, VP for Energy, Environment, and Safety Policy at General Motors, Dan Sperling with the California Air Resources Board and UC Davis, and Forrest Beenham, VP of Government Relations at Coda Automotive. Let's go to our first audience question, please.
Hi, my name is Pat Riley, and I'm with a PR and company, and we are working on a public-private partnership to speed EV preparation and adoption with commercial and residential real estate holders here in the Bay Area. And I guess I have some questions related to consumer adoption. We've been talking to a lot of stakeholders, and one of which was the largest Nissan dealership here. And they said that they've got such a backlog of orders for Leafs right now as a result of the issues in Japan. And when consumers are coming into their lot, they're not interested in any kind of hybrid. They strictly want a full EV vehicle. And he's expecting that his sales, all electric vehicle sales, will represent at least maybe 50, even 60% within the next 2 years for him in the Bay Area. And I'm wondering if people aren't underestimating consumer demand as a result of the high price of gas and inflation and other pressures on consumers about the desire to switch to EV vehicles.
Thank you. What? Let's go with that. You know, are these things, could you be surprised on the upside?
Just to jump in, yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Coda differs from several of the folks on this panel because we only produce an electric car company. We're the only electric car from an electric car company. So we absolutely think that demand is a little bit larger than what most people think. We've read even GM studies that say 40% of adult drivers want to drive or own an electric vehicle. So we're in business selling an electric car only because we believe that this demand is out there, Ms. Riley. So we think that there's great demand there. And
I should also mention briefly that we invited someone from Nissan to be part of this. It didn't work out scheduling-wise, but we'll definitely have Nissan and other companies here as we continue this dialogue here at Climate One. Mike Robinson, could you be surprised on the upside?
Well, sure. I think we want to be prepared for that, and we are making investments to be prepared for that in terms of having our manufacturing capacity able to make adjustments to the volumes that I talked about earlier. We've got a CEO that is driven to be able to do that. You know, quite frankly, we're all fierce competitors. We have a lot of common ground from a policy standpoint. We're all trying to beat each other's brains in from a marketing standpoint and from a customer satisfaction standpoint. So we want to be able to take advantage of those opportunities and increase our volume. And I do think there will be pockets, particularly in California, where the demand far exceeds the demand in other parts of the country just because of the California consumer being different and you know, for all kinds of reasons. So I think it's possible. I hope
would that
it
be
is.
Good for General Motors, given that I think you're selling because of the huge cost of developing the Volt? You're not making money yet on the Volt, so you're going to be selling more of something that you're losing money on?
It sounds like a cocktail party joke to, you know, we're losing money on every one, but we'll make it up in volume. It depends on how you look at the investment. This is a long-term investment for us. I give Toyota credit for the Prius. I mean, I talked to economists 10 years ago that would look at the cost of the technology and would look at the price of gasoline and say, this doesn't pencil. Why would anybody buy one?
Well, it didn't make sense when gas was a dollar.
Well, no. Yeah. But I give Toyota credit for seeing the long term and seeing the opportunity and creating enough buzz with consumers to develop an interest and a market for that vehicle, even at a time when you look at it and say, well, it doesn't pencil from a pure economic standpoint. I think this is maybe not the same, but in a comparable kind of way, a long-term vision we have about the technology. I think we want to be perceived as leaders, and I think we've got a good approach to the problem, solving the problem.
Let's get to our next
Dan Sperling, quickly.
Just to summarize, you know, I think there is a strong commitment on both the vehicle side and the consumer side to electrification, vehicle electrification. Consumers really, we've seen this in market research at UC Davis that we've done since 1990. People really like the concept of an electric vehicle and electric motors. You know, it gets away from combustion, gets away from fossil fuels. The challenge is to figure out how to provide a product that they really will buy. And that's a big question. You know, is it a pure EV? Is it a hybrid, plug-in hybrid with a small battery, with a big battery? And that's wide open. That's where we really don't know. And how much volume you get in each of those categories is something that we're all going to be learning in the coming years.
And they're fun to drive, and they're fast. Let's get to the next question quickly.
Yeah, my question, my name is Carter McCree from Presidio Graduate School, and my question had to do with the service model. And how are you going to assure that emotional connection you were talking about earlier that comes with buying a vehicle if you're just providing a service? I mean, why do I care which bus I get on or that sort of thing?
Well, that's...
Bill Reiner?
That's interesting because it gets back to, and we were talking about this earlier, you guys missed a great conversation back in the green room. It's who owns the customer, okay? If I'm going to build a car, and today's model is you come and buy a Toyota from me, I own the customer, you're going to come back to me for service and other things. But now I'm providing a service, and that service is just as easily owned by the electric utility that plugs in and communicates with you, or by the service provider of Zipcar or City Car Share, or by maybe somebody that has internet capabilities, Wi-Fi capabilities. It could be a Google or a Qualcomm or somebody like that who's communicating to the cars, because we're going to provide a lot of telematics in this. So it's we don't know that answer yet, and if you know, I'll buy the answer from you. But we're making a lot of this up as we go along.
We might have to learn a lot from folks that have been in that business longer than we have. We haven't been doing that.
No.
There's probably other industries that we could learn from.
But if you look at Zipcar, and I'll bring them out, if you look at the loyalty to the Zippies, I think it's like 85 or 90% loyal back to the program and hugely loyal to the car they're driving. So you can't ignore the demographics. Even though they're not making money yet, you can't ignore the demographics of that.
Next question, please.
Hi, yes, I'm Jay Friedland from Plug in America. We're a consumer advocacy group for electric vehicles, and I personally had an electric vehicle and driven it over 80,000 miles in the last 10 years. And I guess my question is twofold. One, if you look at the Prius phenomenon, which I think was really sort of borne out, where one person in a neighborhood bought a Prius, and then what you saw was the neighbors going, wow, well, that car could work for me, and wait, gas prices are now getting higher and higher. What? How could that affect consumer demand in terms of people actually seeing these vehicles on the road? Because every time I talk to someone and they ride my car, they drive my car, they're like, I want one of these cars. There's no question, but I'm one person. Yeah. And so the other question I guess I would
Jay,
add.
Let's hold it to one. And sure, yeah, sure. We got in line there. Thank you. Yeah. So the neighborhood effect.
Yeah, there'll be a coolness effect and a neighborhood effect with some of these vehicles for sure. I think we've seen some of that already. I think the bigger piece of it, from my perspective, is the comfort level. I said earlier in our small group, I think a lot of people are agnostic right now. And I know you've done studies, Dan, that talk about the desire of people to own electric. I think there's still among a lot of folks a wait-and-see attitude about it. They want to test. They want to see how the technology actually performs, let other people be the early adopters. But I do think... there's that opportunity as people get more comfortable with the experience by seeing others do it. That could have a big influence on how big the market gets. That's why I said earlier, I want the technology to work. I don't want fits and starts with our competitors having problems or us having problems with the technology.
Jay, I helped launch the Prius and the RAV4, the one you're driving, actually. And we did exactly the same viral marketing, internet-based marketing, and that really what it was. It wasn't so much the neighborhood stuff, but that's a double-edged sword because now we've moved to Facebook and Twitter. And let me say, a success, there's a million successes and you get all these tweets, but a failure, everybody knows about it instantly. So we have to be incredibly careful about this viral marketing. It can really come back and bite you. So that's what we're really looking at now.
Bill Reinert is National Manager at Toyota. We also heard from Mike Robinson, VP at General Motors. Our other guests here at Climate One today are Forrest Beenham from Coda Automotive, Oliver Kuttner from Edison 2, and Dan Sperling from UC Davis and the California Air Resources Board. Let's have our next audience question, please.
Good morning, gentlemen. My name is Roger Avery. I'm an independent consultant. I'm retired from BART. That's the subway system here from their engine. I was a manager in engineering. The issue of people reducing gas emissions and all of that comes down to making more people use the electric vehicles. And one way to do that is to work that in with public transit.
Yeah.
That means putting in charging stations, in park and rides, BART stations. Uh-huh. There are transit stations in the city where I live. We have to do that. To do that, we have to have standards of how much power you're going to draw, what the safety is going to be, which requires changes to the National Electric Code, which is at least a three-year cycle. The 2011 has just come out. So how 2015 is going to work with public charging stations is a real problem, and it's going to take more than that. I've worked on PV, and the standard in the National Electric Code has taken at least 9 years to get there. So how do we make these charging stations get put in a safe way and get the metering done, and because it's illegal to sub-meter in the state of California, so you can't have one person selling it. Big problem.
Thank you. So how are we going to get this move quickly? The infrastructure, some people think the public charging part actually moves very slowly.
Let me say something controversial, and there is some question how much public charging you even need.
Yeah.
I mean, people are going to... The evidence seems to be that people say they want these public charging stations out there, but you know, maybe if you put a little Potemkin village kind of things out there, and they think they're out... I'm only joking. But it's that people think they want it, but then actually after they buy the vehicle, and this is early evidence, they don't hardly ever use it. And so...
And as a society, we want them to charge at home at night when there's that excess electricity in the system, right?
So it's better. And
Bill Reiner?
We said range anxiety, and I don't really buy range anxiety because I've driven electric cars long enough, and I took my wife out of a Lexus and put her into a little Econ, little 50-mile electric car. And we learned how to deal with it. What we don't learn about and what we can't deal with, and why I kind of disagree with you a little bit on public charging, is we can't deal with range non-repeatability. And the problem is all the hotel loads, it's your heating and your cooling and your demisting and your lights and your wipers, that all comes off your traction battery. So you can easily take your Leaf and drive it into San Francisco in the day and have plenty of charge to get back home. But then you get the monsoonal rains coming in and you're running your defroster and your wipers and your lights and you're caught up on I-280 traffic and you're going 5 miles an hour. Well, that's a diurnal load. That load continues regardless of how far you've got to go. And so I think that we do need public charging in areas to solve not range anxiety but range repeatability when you get sudden shifts in weather. That's where I'm coming.
Bill Reinertsen, National Manager at Toyota. Let's have our next audience question, please.
Yeah, another question relating to the charging stations. Wilfred Welch of EQ Wind, we're down in Santa Clara, and it's wind turbine and solar-driven power stations that'll go in big box stores and also support for truck fleets that are in urban areas. Okay, and I really just want to know your sense from these five different companies, as to the kind of rollout options that you see for charging stations, public and privately owned. Any comments on that? I would welcome. Thank you.
Well, I'll give the quick response that I think that we're going to definitely see companies will put in stations for their employees, and they'll pay for it. And that's good, you know, because part of the theme here is government, in case we haven't noticed, doesn't have a whole lot of cash around to be spending on these things. So I think we will see employers putting it in. We'll see big box stores like Costco and Target putting in as a convenience and attraction for their customers. And then the question is, beyond that, you know, how much is needed and how much we need to invest and strategically where do we put it? But we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I would say
Mike Robinson.
We certainly are in support of public infrastructure, but we're not counting on it and we don't depend on it. And our model is basically home charging is sufficient for most folks. Workplace charging is a good idea. We're encouraging employers where we can. But we're not, to Dan's point about budgets and the mundane issues associated with finance, I've seen the books in California, Dan. I'm not counting
it's
on
not
a lot
pretty.
Of public. It's not pretty. So we're not counting on that. And I think the model for most of us works with the home charging. And the cost, of course, is negligible unless you want to put in your own charging station at your house. You can charge in your garage with 120 or 240. Right. So it works on that model. The public stations would be great, but I'm not counting on them.
Let's go to the next audience question, please.
Hi, my name is Jan Alfwiegel. I'm from Marin County. And I have a question for Dan. Excuse my voice. ABAG and the MTC right now, as I'm sure you're aware, are going through a review process of transportation projects that are identified to meet the goals of Senate Bill 375, the Sustainable Communities legislation. In Marin, I was one of the authors of a proposal submitted to MTC for funding of EV charging infrastructure. And my question is, MTC is looking at a broad array of projects submitted by the 9-county Bay Area region for road maintenance, for public transit, for infill development, for EV infrastructure, for unfunded existing projects that still need to go ahead. Where do you see electric vehicle infrastructure ranking among those priorities as MTC looks at its limited funding sources and looking at these different choices that they have to make? Where do EVs rate?
Thank you. Okay, Dan?
And I guess I repeat what I said before, and that is that this is a struggle, is figuring out how many and where to put them. And, looking at it from a government perspective, as I said, there's not a lot of cash around. So I would think that creating the incentives for companies or local governments to do it, working in partnership is really the key on this. And I just don't see a lot of money being devoted because, partly what Mike said is for the plug-in hybrids, they don't really need much public infrastructure. So it's just the pure battery EVs. And it's going to be slow how they evolve out there and what the market is. So I'm very bullish on plug-in electric vehicles, which means including the hybrids and the pure battery EVs. And so I'm you know, I get nervous about government spending a lot of money on this. I think there's a better way. We can create the incentives for the partnerships and industry and employers to do it, but I worry about local government spending their money on something like this.
We got about 4 minutes left. Let's try to get one or two more questions in. So quick questions, quick answers, and we'll wrap this up. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Bill Zeller. I'm with the City of San Francisco Department of the Environment, and we're actually working now, actively planning infrastructure projects for EVs. And I have a question for the auto manufacturers. One of the big issues is the battery electrics versus the plug-in hybrids. They obviously have significantly different requirements. Anybody care to take a stab at how those will bisect the plug-in market, those two types of vehicles? Would really help us.
Or you mean level two versus level one?
No, I'm thinking more in terms of battery electrics versus plug-in hybrids the market will bisect.
I think that our General Motors range extended electric vehicle and the Toyota plug-in hybrids are compatible.
Yeah.
They can use the same infrastructure. They're very much less expensive overall for the society to adopt, and I think you'll see the plug-ins the plug-in hybrids or the range-extended electric cars have a very robust market initially. EVs may come, but they're going to come later and slower.
Next question, please.
Hi, my name is Heather Barton, and I'm also with Pat Riley at PR & Company, working on the public-private partnership for EV readiness. And my question is, where do you see the gaps in education for the public for the EV infrastructure and campaign, as well as where do you see the Bay Area in terms of global marketing for EV readiness?
Well, Mike Robinson?
Bay Area is a huge target for us, and I think every automotive manufacturer. We've sold 2,000 volts so far, and half of them are California. We've got seven markets that we've targeted initially. Half of them have gone to California, so you can tell how many the rest of the six target markets have received. It's going to continue to be an area of emphasis for us. I think San Francisco is probably more ready for EVs than the average car market by far. So it's going to continue to get a lot of attention from us. I would guess my competitors are going to say the same thing.
Partners and colleagues.
Absolutely.
As well, yes.
Yeah.
Forrest Beenham.
We also, you asked about gaps in education. I think I would categorize that as there's some misperceptions out there. You know, we talked briefly about range anxiety, and you mentioned putting your wife into a 50-mile vehicle. The national average is 34 miles that someone drives per day. So when you have cars that guarantee 100 miles plus, it really is adequate. So I think in terms of education, we need to educate people about that. In addition to educate them when they're making a choice about which car, what the range means. In other words, there are different standards. There's US 06, LA 04. There are different standards which mean different ranges. And so I think it's incumbent upon us as an industry to drill down on that and to educate consumers.
What are you really going to get out of our cars? Not what you're going to get in some test cycle. What are you really going to get?
With the windshield wipers on.
But here's what I think society has to change. There's almost no customer that buys the car for their average use. They buy it for their one-time use, and that's why you see big SUVs that are raised up with trailer hitches on them, with single-occupant cars. Until we can get society to understand that there's a multiple-use, average-use model that's actually the best way to go, and we can provide other mechanisms for them at the dealership or at Hertz when they need different modes of transportation, that's what has to happen. That has to happen.
Last question. Yes, sir.
My name is... Excuse me. My name is Virian Bousset. I have a vocational school in West Oakland called the Oakland Institute of Automotive Technology. I'm right in the process now of converting a three-axle diesel truck to electric by way of a grant through air quality management. And one of the things I'm running into is coming up with a decent battery. My concept is to go after a lithium polymer. What's your opinion about these lithium polymer batteries?
Let me also preface this by saying we heard, some of us heard former CIA Director Jim Woolsey yesterday say that there's going to be some breakthroughs in technology, battery technology, whether it's nano, ceramic, et cetera. So let's answer his question as well as the battery breakthrough.
Yeah.
There's a lot of theories about that, but that's not what I'm hearing from our R&D guys.
No, our guys don't believe that either.
Okay, and how about the gentleman's question about lithium?
Polymer. very expensive.
Yeah.
And so you also have to consider what can be mass produced. And so when you're talking about total cost of ownership and the cost of the car, you need to keep in mind that these types of new technologies are extremely expensive and therefore not easily adopted.
And if you're looking at a one-off conversion, which I think is what the thing was, I'd probably look at maybe not the most advanced battery out there, but maybe one of the most rugged.
Nickel hydride.
Yeah, nickel metal hydride. I mean, you can pull them out of. I think you can get them from RAV4 EVs, not that any are broken, but I think you can get that. And I'd look at that. To get the idea of electrification is far more than the battery. It's the power electronics and the cooling of the power electronics and all the inverters and all that stuff that's key.
And, just a closing thought on all this. We have talked here about all of these questions and uncertainties. It's a technology market. In the end, it's the theme that we were talking about before. We have to work together, the industry and the government. And I did just want to mention, something in California. There's the plug-in electric vehicle collaborative, where it is all of these companies, the utilities, the car companies, the government agencies, the academics, and at UC Davis, we played a role in helping this put this report together. It's an ongoing effort, and I would just remind everyone of it that this is what's needed, and this is how we're really going to move forward because we don't know the answers, to most of these questions, exactly how it's going to play out.
But you keep coming to Climate One, you'll figure out what the smartest people can figure. Two quick ones to follow up on. Bill Reiner, I want to get your thought on Feebates, which is something that some people are looking at as a way to sort of another incentive to get people into more efficient cars. Where's Toyota on Feebates?
I can't answer for Toyota. I can answer personally that I worry about populations that have limited means to move up into this stuff, and I worry about environmental justice. And so I understand that how the Feebates work, but some people that don't make as much money as I have to have a bigger, larger car, and they shouldn't be.
I'm surprised by what you say because people that tend to have less income are going, first of all, they don't tend to buy new cars.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true.
But even if they did, they tend to buy the smaller, more efficient vehicles.
And they would get rewarded in the Feebate system, right? They get cash on the hood.
Right. So can we sign you up for Feebates, Bill?
Too much of a libertarian for that.
Last question is, I wanted to mention a quote from the American CEO of Hyundai, who they put out 50 mile per gallon average in 2025, and the CEO, John Krafcik, said, we don't know how we're going to get there right now, but we do have a roadmap. And that's very different than some companies saying, we're not going to commit to any more than what we already know how to do. He's saying, we're putting a goal out there, and we're going to figure out how to get there. That's more risky. Is that the kind of leadership we should see, Dan Sperling?
We certainly need leadership in all levels here. It's kind of, it's the same theme. We don't know how this play out. And it is leadership. It's leadership in the car, from the big car companies, from innovation, entrepreneurship from the little ones, showing leadership there, leadership in the policy world. We need, we can kind of, make a little fun of President Obama's 1 million car goal, but we need those aspirations. We need that leadership, and we might not achieve it, and it might be some hype to it, but without some hype, we don't want too much hype. there's some fine, range in there of how much hype we want. But we need that, and that's how this is going to happen. If we don't have the leadership, if we don't have a little hype, it's not going to happen.
And we have to end it there. Our thanks to Dan Sperling from UC Davis and the California Air Resources Board, Mike Robinson, VP at General Motors, Bill Reinert, National Manager at Toyota, Forrest Beenham, VP of Government Relations at Coda Automotive, and Oliver Kuttner, CEO at Edison 2. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming to Climate One today and listening on the radio.
Thank you. Thanks, man.